got in around 10 o'clock this morning.
Yeah,
but he's getting in today and then coming to the seminar.
Yeah, but it would have been an early flight.
You guys are younger and tougher than us all.
No, it's because when you fly from someplace in the Midwest, you don't have options of which flights you can take. You can only take the overnight flight.
Well, there are multiple options.
You can go through. No, I was supposed to be there for an hour.
Okay. What was wrong at Heathrow?
One other hour was shut down.
Did you, are you,
hopefully,
did you come in from Oslo, or did you come
from Oslo?
Yeah, but you have to try Trondheim, Oslo, Oslo here, right? Yeah, so it's a haul, 6, 7, 8 hours probably, all told. Yeah, that's the problem with connections, is that you end up eating a lot of time.
Well, apparently there were problems at Heathrow, so...
Oh, there are?
Well, this morning.
If it was supposed to be there by 10...
I think his flight would have gotten early, though. Because he was coming
There
were
problems
Detroit,
in terms
right?
of strike or something?
No, just
one of the
railways. Oh,
all right. Well, we can ask him on his flight.
Good. It's the gentleman from Heathrow.
Yeah, we were wondering why you were late.
Stuck on a bus.
Oh.
You're not late. You're not late. It hasn't started yet. Hi, Richard Solomon. Hi, nice to meet you. Yeah. You're actually the cleanup hitter in terms of speaking, translating all of this sophisticated debate directly to the UK context. So that seemed to be an appropriate transition to open discussion. So, the logic is that Jenny will go. I'm just going to lay out a couple of things conceptually, and then Jenny will go first with a broad overview, and then Latvia, which I find very interesting. That's okay. Well, you know, Latvia has some things to tell us, given a whole variety of things about Latvia, and certainly also the similarities and differences to Estonia, about which we know a lot from the book. So it'd be Jenny followed by Antonio in the case of Spain, John in the case of Norway, and then Scott with the UK and England. And what is it, maximum 20 minutes?
Yeah.
Yellow card, red card. Yellow card is you have 2 minutes left. Red card, I cut off your micro. No.
Red card, we have to leave the
building. Yeah. Right, you're out of the game. Yeah.
It would be more logical than if the yellow card was we're actually already running over.
Probably. Actually, it would be more logical if we had vuvuzelas and we started howling. But, you know, so. Anyway, we really do have to stick to 20 minutes because add a slight delay in start and then add my presentation if we want to have time for discussion at the end. Four by 20 is we're going to add up to about an hour and a half for presentation, so we need to keep the time. So think about that, what you want to emphasize. I am encouraging you, of course, to squeeze a little on the front and digress on Latvia. But
I got that, because I thought, well, if you're doing that, I will squeeze on the front. But I'm trying to...
Yeah, I don't know. I hope we're not going to overlap too much, but I just pulled a few things from the book.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, all right. Well, that's... Sorry.
It's fine.
Okay. All right, should we start? It's 5 past.
I'm sure there'll people coming in.
People will come in. In terms of moving this forward, it's just the old...
We have an upgrade to do.
No, that's fine. I just want to make sure I know what I'm doing.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Right, thank you.
Yep. Oh, and is this on? Does it matter?
It's smaller for the
flight,
isn't
it?
It's smaller.
It is on, though. It is on, but I don't know that it matters. Okay. Okay, I guess we should get started. I want to welcome you to this. My understanding is this is the final seminar for this series that they're thanks to both to the Higher Education Innovation Fund, but also to LSE and to the NHS Confederation for organizing these seminars, and in particular this seminar. I'm Richard Saltman. What I'd like, I'm going to serve as chair, and I'm going to take chair's prerogative for about 3 minutes and raise a couple of conceptual issues that may or may not frame the cases that will follow, but perhaps we can come back to as touchstones or markers in terms of organizing and steering an ungainly discussion about, because the topic is ungainly. Decentralization, as most of you are aware, is not really a topic. It's not a strategy. It's a zone. It's a whole set of activities. It's an umbrella under which sit a wide range of different things, some of which are in conflict with each other, and some of which reflect different academic disciplines, interpretations of what's appropriate. So decentralization by itself opens the door to discussion rather than being something that simply defines a clear path. I like to think about decentralization as having three functional dimensions, three elements that go into it. One is a political dimension that has to do with policy, strategy. It's the kind of thing that national decision makers want to be involved in, but in, depending on the country, there may be regional governments, there may be local governments, and again, depending on the country, and by the way, I'm talking about the public sector here. In some countries, even inside the public sector, the hospital itself may be making some of these policy decisions. It can be a shared relationship. Second of the three is the administrative function. That's the operational management, the nuts and bolts, if you will. And the third, carved out from both the political and the administrative, is the fiscal. That's both raising the money, spending the money. And the reason that fiscal is separate is first because everybody wants to talk about it, and secondly because it's the main target of all of the sustainability arguments the health systems are currently grappling with, which in turn lead back to various approaches to decentralization. As I said, the three different dimensions are different, but they are linked, connected, and influence, often interacting together, influence what happens inside systems. However, by teasing these apart, we have some way to analyze what we're looking at in terms of the behavior of specific decision makers, specific policy makers, decision makers at the hospital level, and so forth. So it becomes useful to see which predominates. The two broad arguments that are typically put forward in terms of decentralization is what can be called a democratizing argument, that it, decentralization moves decisions closer to the people, democracy, small d, in the way that the Nordic countries, for example, would see it. It's also an argument that is seen in terms of efficiency. Actually, there's two different forms of efficiency. One is knowing what the population needs, what you're serving. And then the second is the economist's version. I guess that first was a more of a public health version. But the second economist version of efficiency is the idea that if you have more units, you can create competition by having choice between them, and that in turn will generate units that act more effectively, more efficiently, and in theory, cost less. So those are two general arguments. Different groups use them in different ways, as I've already suggested. And the last of the four broad conceptual elements has to do with the opposite of decentralization, which is recentralization, which has become a major policy direction in a number of countries across Europe, and has become an important piece of the policy landscape. As you will hear from John Magnussen in Norway, but it's considerably more than just Norway. It has to do with recentralizing the political dimension, recentralizing fiscal dimension, particularly the funding part of it, and depending on the country, consolidating administrative decisions in bigger units. In other words, the efficiency argument trumps the democratizing argument. this again comes from the sustainability. There are a variety of reasons why this is happening, but it is happening. And it raises a lot of questions around the extent to which decentralization is presumed to be appropriate or a solution, I guess. Nigel. in that sense, it's a, you can say that re-centralization is a form of rejecting decentralization to a certain degree. However, what also appears to be happening, and you can judge from Norway, and you can think about this as we look at other cases more broadly, is that what happens is there's a balance in any system between central and decentral dimensions on each of the three functional items, political, administrative, and fiscal. There's a sharing of authority with different balance points in different countries. And the question is whether those balance, to what extent those balance points have changed, to what extent re-centralization is now becoming predominant, but then there's still elements of decentralization. Denmark would be a case where they've decentralized some of the prevention at the same time that they've re-centralized fiscal and fiscal control and also a degree of policy control. So we could talk about that as well. We have four very distinguished presenters to give you perspective on this. The first, Jenny Bremer, is the director of the European Healthcare Management Association in Brussels, who's going to speak about present a broad conceptual overview, hopefully in ways that I did not step on badly with my own comments, and then talk about one particular case, which is Latvia, which is actually a very interesting example. Second presenter is Antonio Duran, who's principal and head of Texalud in Sevilla, and a well-known consultant for WHO Euro and for the World Bank, who's going to present the Spanish case, another complex, very interesting set of circumstances and events. John Magnussen, as I mentioned earlier, from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, will tell us what's been transpiring in Norway in a Nordic system where decentralization, I want to say it's close to God, but I'm not sure that God counts in this, even though it's a Lutheran. This gets complicated, but decentralization is very important, and the fact that it's not as important as it was perhaps tells us something. And then Scott Greer, who's at the University of Michigan and also a visiting fellow at LSE, who's going to take you through some of the trials and tribulations in the UK and specifically in England. As far as how we're going to proceed, each speaker is going to have 20 minutes. I brought along a couple of remnants from South Africa, which I will use with some discretion, in hopes that we will be able to protect about a half an hour at the end of the session for a broader discussion and question. So, Jenny.
Thank you.
Escape should get me out of here. It doesn't. That gets me out. You are. Where are you?
I think I'm that one.
This one?
Good. Yeah, that's me.
All right, and then we need. Oh, up there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard. Some of what you've said will reappear on my slides, which I think just goes to prove that although this is incredibly complicated, there is a bit of consistency in there. Okay. When we're talking about decentralisation, what I'm going to do is just go through a little bit of the theory, a quick comment on what's happening at a European level, and then look at Latvia, and then some reflections on what all this might mean. Basically, the policy challenge and the problem we're trying to answer is what's the optimum level or tier of governance administration for the different facets of our health system? As Richard's already said, when we're talking about this, it doesn't necessarily mean all of the health system or all of the fiscal bits or all of the policy bits or all of the administrative bits may move to the same level. And what you see when you look across Europe is a really complex picture of different interactions between the different systems. Always when we're trying to make any policy change, the big question is the resistance to change from the people in the system. So how popular is this going to be and how accepted is this going to be? And the amount of disruption is this policy change going to cause versus the perceived necessity of doing different. So there's always that tension there. So what can we learn when we look at Europe? Well, just to kind of pick up on some of the things Richard said, at its most simple level, when you're decentralising, you're transferring power and authority from a higher level to a lower level of government. Richard's talked about the different dimensions, and I've already said they can play out differently in different countries. I think it's important to say that what decentralisation is contested as a notion. That some people would argue that devolution is a form of decentralisation. Other people would say it isn't. It is nothing to do with decentralisation. Devolution is about setting up a new form of independent government, and that is not decentralisation. Others would say that privatisation is a form of decentralisation, that moving services out of provision by the state into the private sector is a form of decentralisation. Others may come back and counter that the providers may be operating at a national or indeed an international level. So how is that decentralisation? So the definition is contested, and the debate is often very, very heated. And people often will have a preferred position on this. I should probably come out now. I worked for local government for 10, 12 years, and often across the table from Nigel, they're rarely throwing things at each other. I think more generally being much more polite and agreeing. And so, passionate believer in the positive benefits of decentralisation. So I'll come up front. So it's complicated, and when you look across Europe, you really begin to see some of the complexities within there. First of all, there's different names for different levels of governance in different countries. So in Spain, when Antonio, we're talking about the autonomous communities, a huge range of powers, both fiscal, administrative and political. You've got provinces in Germany, you've got the Länder, very, very powerful bodies, and in other areas you've got regions. So in Sweden, for example, you've got regions, and in the UK we call them countries. Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, although Scotland omitted devolution. So when you also look at countries, often countries will have areas with special status, Copenhagen in Denmark, Madeira in Portugal. And even when things have the same name, so for example, the region of Italy, there can be real differences. So in Italy, Trentino Alto, one region basically operates as two for historical reasons. So as you begin to unpeel the onion, it gets more and more complicated. Just to make things even more difficult, some countries have intermediate bodies without specific functions. That sounds a bit odd, but in Sweden, the county councils, who have responsibility for provision of healthcare, increasingly different county councils are beginning to cooperate and collaborate and form small associations to work together. An example in an English context would be the West Midlands Local Government Association. There is a national local government association, but the counties or the authorities in the West Midlands feel proud and special for being part of the West Midlands and have formed a separate sub-association. No specific function beyond kind of coordination. So it's a complicated picture. This is taken from an excellent book from the European Observatory, edited by Richard, on decentralisation. And what I've done is just pull two countries out across Europe, just to give us some idea of some of the differences we're talking about. And I just want to look at the level of regions and local government. In Finland, and Finland's an interesting example, because like a number of the Nordic countries, they've begun to re-centralise a bit. But when you look at what they've been re-centralising from very, very small units of population at a local government level, while now serving a population of about 12,000, and with some responsibility for healthcare. Tiny, tiny unit. So re-centralising in a Finnish context means something completely different to what it might mean in an English or UK context. So you've got much smaller numbers. In Germany, the regions, the Länder, you've got 16 Länder, elected bodies serving populations of about 5 million, bigger than many European countries. Huge bodies, very, very powerful, but with an enormous number of local government serving tiny populations. So you've got this complete disparate mix. And actually, when I worked for the Local Government Association, we did quite a lot of work for Germany. And for them, the interplay between the national level, the federal, the land and the local government, plus all these other bodies in between, was hugely complex. And they said a huge amount of time was spent trying to negotiate and compete and fight with each other. So very different pictures. The key arguments I won't go into, which is already mentioned. The one thing I will say is they're often used for both centralisation and decentralisation. So for decentralisation, people will talk about allocative efficiency, you're more sensitive to local needs, you can push the money where it's needed. The centralists will say, actually, you need to pull it right back up because you need to be able to redistribute the wealth across the country to the population so it can run both ways. And indeed, the cost efficiency argument, centralists saying you get many more bangs for your buck if you purchase at a national level, and at a local level, the decentralists saying actually you minimise duplication, you can be much more sensitive to local needs, and therefore much more efficient. The same around democracy. One point I will make around the democracy issue is that when you're talking about decentralising, there needs to be a high level of credibility and trust to the body that you're decentralising to. It's very unlikely to make this work if generally the professionals in the health service don't trust local government, for example, or regional government. If there's not a good relationship or not a high level of trust, it's going to be very difficult to make this work. Which is an interesting question with what's happening in England at the moment, but we'll leave that for later. The more detailed arguments for decentralisation. Better penetration to the hard-to-reach communities. You're close to the ground, you're close to your population, you can get in there. You enhance civic participation and build social capital at a local level. You can be more creative and innovative in terms of particularly providing healthcare, in providing local jobs and building and supporting the local economy. It can reduce red tape. And strengthen the local political administration. Argument, again, played both ways, is that you get simplified monitoring and evaluation at a local level because it's smaller, you're much clearer, much closer to it. Antonio may have comments on that from Spain, because I think that's debatable. Okay, just a very quick mention of Latvia. Huge push of decentralisation in the early 90s in 1993. Fiscal, political, administrative decentralisation right down to local government. And reversed about 4 years later. And the reasons for the reversal are interesting. There was a high level of commitment to the decentralisation nationally. But there were very... Latvia's economy is not great. It wasn't great then, so there were big fiscal constraints in the country. Local government was grappling with providing healthcare, housing and social care and also welfare benefits. So they suddenly, this huge amount of responsibility came down to the local level. And so they got the responsibility, but they didn't have the funding and the administrative capacity to really grapple with that, and it caused huge amounts of problems. And talking, we were recently doing a piece of work with someone from Latvia and looking at action to tackle social determinants of health, and what they were saying was there's really high political commitments from the local politicians, from the local community, but they just couldn't handle it. So there was some fiscal re-centralisation in 97. And the irony, when they were talking, what they were saying was, although there was this passionate belief in decentralisation, what became incredibly important was the national and supranational frameworks set by the EU in terms of what some of the minimum standards and what the social welfare system should begin to look like from national. So you have this sort of... passionate acceptance of decentralisation, but there's real reliance on European legislation to actually begin to set a framework around it. And I think there's some interesting lessons there. What's the evidence around decentralization and whether it works? Well, I think ambiguous is probably a good word. There's some evidence around the impact of equity and the ability to cross-subsidize services, and that decentralization can actually lessen equity. But counter to that, you do get more appropriate services with populations with particular needs. But counter to that is you can sometimes lead to problems. So, for example, around access to reproductive health services. Example of that in English context was in the West Midlands in the 70s, it was very, very difficult to get termination of pregnancy because the local health authority didn't basically agree with it. So on the health service, it was very difficult, and there were lots of NGOs in there providing their services, and that changed. So there can be some real tensions around having more sensitive services, but also services being more influenced by people's beliefs. I think one of the key things around decentralisation is, because of the ambiguity of the evidence, essentially decisions around centralisation and decentralisation are political. They're political decisions around your personal set of beliefs around what makes things work, and your belief around, I guess, whether you trust the level you're giving the powers to. When you look across Europe, and we've scratched the surface just looking at Germany and Finland, the complexity and the contextual and historical differences in countries make comparison incredibly difficult. Because even when things look the same, you really need to dig underneath and ask lots of questions about why countries have the system they have. Why Germany has Länder, as opposed to, and Sweden has regions, have very, very different roots. Germany's Länder coming very after post-Second World War, after a very, very powerful government. Spain, very similar history. So, and that can make a real difference to how things work and the level of acceptance and passionate adherence to those ideas. What are the implications? Well, De Vries, I think in late 90s, early 2000, had a look across European countries. And what he saw was centralisation, decentralisation is more or less cyclical. And it tends to it can run in cycles. I think because centralisation, decentralisation are so contextual, and because the context keeps shifting, power and accountability, I think, will continue to move around health systems across Europe. I think you could argue that the demographic change and the need to develop more integrated care services for older people may lead to more decentralisation as local services, housing, social care, health need to come together to meet those needs. England is probably, in healthcare, is probably the most centralised European country. You could say maybe this makes decentralisation more likely.
So Scotland.
Scotland too. Yeah.
Possibly Wales.
Okay, or UK. Yeah, no, they are. But the history is a very, very strongly centralised. Although I think it plays out very differently. Because England, Scotland, because it's smaller, the impact is felt much less because people know everybody. And a lot of them went to school to work at there. But it's a small country, I mean, it's inevitable. So, in conclusion, I think centralisation, decentralisation, things are going to continue moving around the system. It's clear from the recent white paper there's going to be big changes in England. And to what effect that is actually decentralising some of the fiscal and administrative power, I'm not clear about. I don't know if you guys are. Yeah. Okay, Nigel is. I think it's important that managers and clinicians have the skills to begin to meet the change in circumstances. Latvia, I think, is a really good example of what happens when that capacity building and investment in capacity building isn't there. And one of the things that I was very aware of when I worked in England was that many health service managers are not used to working with local politicians and don't spend much time talking to them or engaging with them or understanding the potential benefits of local political leadership. I think we need to think about how you minimise organisational churn. As powers move around the system, it doesn't necessarily mean there has to be huge organisational churn. We will probably keep doing many of the things that we've been doing and delivering the services we've delivered. So it's how do you minimise that as things move around. The diversity across Europe gives an opportunity to learn. As new things are developed, there's a reasonable chance someone will have done something similar somewhere else. But the real health warning there is really, it's important to understand the context when looking at other systems. And really trying to get behind what some of the historical and philosophical beliefs are about how things work. Okay.
Thank you very much. Are there any quick questions specifics beyond the question of England and Scotland? Does anyone would like to raise? Questions of clarification? Okay, if not, we move on. Antonio Duran and the case of Spain.
Thanks.
You didn't put decentralization in quotes.
No need. Right. Good afternoon, first of all. Compared to Latvia, there are a couple of important differences when you think about Spain. Spain is big, and Spain is a country that has had something like 8 civil wars in the last couple of 300 years. Some of them linked to the territorial dilemmas, and we have a collection of 850-something people being killed by an organization that continues to shake up the tree, using the sentence that the politician was using, somebody shakes the tree and we collect the nuts. So in this sense, the case of Spain is a case of a political devolution. It's not a decentralization, and it has to be seen from that perspective. For a number of reasons, it's a country with a very serious polarization at the moment, and therefore I will try to stick to the facts and then avoid, I mean, whenever I will make an interpretation, I will try to be explicit and say this is my view. But the thing is that when you look at the lessons that the Spanish experience can offer to others, it has to be, first of all, very contextual in one sense, and second, my understanding is that the Spanish example shows that political deconcentration, delegation, decentralization requires two things that are not necessarily well considered very often. One is money, because it takes a lot of money to oil that machinery. And when there's money, things go well. When money is scarce, the situation becomes more complicated. And the second is the tools for ensuring some sense of control of the process, which is actually what has happened. It's something similar to what happened in Eastern Europe, that people change the regulatory machinery without having an alternative. And by the time they wanted to replace it, it all became very messy. So I will try to present facts about Spain and then probably make the discussion later on more political. I will speak about the division of competencies, the reason behind the evolution, which I've already announced, how it works, and the results. Very quickly, we have changed a lot, we're big, but we come from a position in which we are high in the health rankings. Our health system is surprisingly good. The Health Affairs this month has a panegyric whatever of Spain, which is true. I mean, we are fourth in life expectancy at birth, fourth in life expectancy at 65, have a fantastic record in infant mortality. For example, we have gone from 20 to 3, actually in 30 years, which is a fantastic record. And we have done very well in a number of areas. For example, in the reduction of avoidable mortality, both mortality that is sensitive to primary prevention and sensitive to medical interventions, those are reductions of 40, 30, which are very serious successes, right? We're also very happy to see that, for example, the five-year relative survival rates in cancer are now putting us very much in the first division than in the second division where we used to be 20 or 30 years ago, right? We can compare our survival rates from breast cancer, colorectal cancer, lung cancer with the big countries of Europe and so on. And these are things that have taken place while offering a very generous package of services to all residents, not only to all citizens, but also to migrants. And people should remember that we have offered Spanish nationality to 4.5 million people in the last 4 or 5 years, and that the approval rates by the population remain very high. More impressively so, this is done with a fraction of our GDP, which is something like 8 point something, very far away from the 16 of the United States and from the 11, 12 of the French, the Germans, and others. And in terms of per capita expenditure, with something like 27, 28, 2,800 dollars per person per year, again, far from the biggest things. Three quarters of our funding are public, or a bit less, and the majority of the money is spent in primary care, etc. Let's go to the political picture. When Spain recovered democracy after Franco's death in 1970-something, leading to the 1978 constitution, health was put there as a fundamental right, and the existing Bismarckian insurance model was shifted towards a national health system explicitly based on decentralization. This is a very important argument because it was not by chance, it was not by caprice, it was part of the solution that was designed at that time to avoid bigger problems. And there was another law discussed in 2003, but it didn't change much. The interesting thing is that we have seen this year in Spain a political debate in which the government has been promoting for the legal regime of a very important region like Catalonia, a federal-like perspective. But Spain is not a federation. Spain is a kingdom. And the Constitutional Court had to remember, listen, this is not feasible. So in a way, we are in this situation in which the regional ministries of health, 17, which were created by direct election of 17 regional parliaments, of very different size. Andalusia has 8 million people, other provinces have less than 1 million. They are supposed to be coordinated by the Ministry of Health, but the important thing is that regions spend 90% of public funds. These public funds are non-earmarked, and this means that the state gives 9 out of 10 euros to the regions and says, now you follow my advice. But it's being given by the Ministry of Finance to the Ministry of Finance of the region through a parliament, which creates enormous difficulties for the central ministry to set up health priorities in reality, right? Because the regional governments are using budgets, the 30% of which is the health money. So therefore, I mean, there are all kinds of opportunities to. There are problems with differences in health outcomes and in health financing, and very serious problems of variation in terms of access, quality, safety, etc. Some people don't like to see this. Some people believe that it's a tragedy. I think that we need to address this, and it's not necessarily a tragedy, but it's a real issue that needs to be addressed. Now, for example, in terms of life expectancy between regions has a difference of about 3 years, which is not too much, but it's not too little. It's a substantial difference. And it's somehow mostly related to income, but not only related to income. Some authors studied this and saw that after 30 years of resource allocation under democracy, the decentralization has had no effect on the convergence in health status. In other words, some provinces have won a little, some provinces have lost a little, but the range of the variation remains the same. The difference between the top and the bottom is exactly the same. The scissors have not even been shot a little. What is more serious, and it's surprisingly, it goes rather unnoticed. It's not that it's unnoticed, but I mean, it's not high on the agenda, is the difference between public healthcare expenses per person, which is not less than something like 40%. So if you take the budgets recognized by the different regional governments, they will range from 16-23% the Basque Country to 1,000 in the Balearic Islands, which are one of the richest regions, by the way. So the difference between the top and the bottom is so big. And when you look at whether this reflects political identity, you will see that it doesn't, because on the left-hand map, you have the so-called, because this was presented by the Federation of Associations in Defense of Public Health Systems, they were making more or less the thesis that the socialists will be more spending more, the others will be spending less, but it was not true, because Andalusia and the Balearic Islands are run by socialists and they were spending rather little. Galicia and Madrid and Valencia were spending rather little, and then the nationalists were spending rather little, Catalonia and the Canary Islands. So it has more to do with the specific context of the local government and the local politics than with any centrally designed scheme, which is consistent with the idea that it's money that is not earmarked, it's given to the region. Very importantly, this is from 2007, the last one was from this year in budget. This is on executed budget, expenditures per se. And if you look at the kind of brown thing, the variation between 2007 and versus 2006 is you will see figures of 11%, 15%, 19%, which are enormous increases of expenditure. For example, the capital expenditure in Spain between 2000 and 2008 has grown by 130%, which means that the buildings and the equipment and so on have been renewed. There was a kind of spending spree, so to speak. And the figures are impressive, right? You go from $360 to $2,700, and the fraction of the GDP from 5% to 8%, and so on and so forth. Lots of variability between regions. It's not true that the system offers the same services all over the territory. Depending on the hospital, your fate will be very different. If you go to a good hospital and you have a good godfather to take you there, you will get much better outcomes than if you go to a bad hospital. The centralized idea or the original centralized idea of having the same resources will not offer the same, for example, use of PTCA or the prostatectomy rates or the cesarean rate, section rates, or even the fatality rates for low mortality DRGs has a variation of 4.5 times, which means that the practical aspects of the day-to-day life in the hospitals is very, very different. 26% of hospitals with more than 500 beds have at least 15% more inefficient indicators than the average, which means that the variation depends a lot on where you are and how much money you have. I found this paper from somebody who actually works and teaches here. Well, I don't have the pleasure, the honor to know, but I'm a bit surprised by the conclusion saying that inequalities in health and healthcare in Spain appear to be driven by income inequalities and inequalities in service use, but not by inequalities in financing and health expenditure. And then defines region states, which is a concept that I don't know, did not exhibit significant difference in health and healthcare. The reality is that, and this we put in the heat that we wrote this year, that the variation on per capita expenditure in the last, say, 20 years among regions, it has only increased. In other words, the government is forced by political pressures to be more giving, tolerant with these kind of things. And to me, this is the most important slide of them all. The most important slide of them all means that if you ask Spaniards, and this come from the quality agency of the National Health System, it's from this year, people who believe that the same health services are offered to all citizens in relation to gender is a big thing in Spain. Women are, you know, big thing. People will tell you, no, does the health system treat men and women the same? Say, people who say, is the system going to treat you differently according to your social class? People say, no, they will not treat you. I mean, if you're rich or poor, you will get the same type of standards. But when it comes to people who believe that they will treat you differently depending on where you live, half of the population, less than half of the population, will only admit that to that. People will say, no, if you live in a rich region, you will get much better care than if you live in a poor region. Quickly, one of the amazing things is that, for example, we don't know how many people work in the national health system. We know the whole time equivalents, but we don't know the people. Because it's like Indiana Jones and whatever, you have to do a lot of effort to see where are these people, and you never find them. It's all, you know? And barriers of language and barriers of other kind are creating some kind of fences that are avoiding the flow of people from one region to the other, right? We have something like 7 health cards, and the information systems are not compatible with each other. A fortune being spent on computers and cards and telecommunications. But the thing is that the connectivity between regional health systems and across the country is very, very low. And there is no systematic assessment of the performance of the national health system simply because you cannot do it. The information is not available. Very important. While decision-making regarding the center has become very vindicative, so to speak, the level of centralization inside the regions has multiplied by a factor of a lot. There's no way that you can disagree. And we're talking about, for example, Andalusia. The distance between the west and the east, I mean, horizontally, is something like 500 kilometers. We're not talking about Latvia, where you go here and there, and then you are, you know, out of the country. There's nothing you can do outside certain very centralized rules. And finally, in order to give you an example of an indication of to what extent it's very difficult to issue any thesis, centralization had whatever in Spain, and it was non-acceptable for political reasons. The performance of the system is satisfactory. I'm not saying that we are having difficulties, and a lot of innovation has taken place, and a lot of very good things have happened. But the body that runs with 17 regional ministers and the central minister, which is called the Interterritorial Council, has been meeting. It cannot vote. It has no executive power. It can only reach agreement by consensus. But importantly, they gathered at the beginning of this year, in March, and look at the agenda that they issued. And it was presented as a big success. They were discussing human resources issues, common services issues, budget sustainability issues, common health policy issue, quality innovation issue, and then, which means that there is a very, very big perception that the majority of the things are left rather on the side. In terms of depending on how much money you will have, things will go one way or the other. And nobody knows what's going to happen now that the budget cuts are going to have an impact on the entire country. The president, I mean, the prime minister has already transferred, established a special fund of 11 billion, a bit less than 11 billion, and gave 4.5 of those billions to Catalonia because of his personal or political electoral needs, saying that this was owed to them, whatever. So it's complicated to give to 7 million people 4 billion euros. The experience, therefore, will depend very much, like I said, on the two things: how money is going to be allocated in the future. I'm not sure that, I mean, there are obviously voices claiming for big recentralization drives. I think it's politically impossible, simply politically impossible. But it remains to be seen what's going to happen with the system in those conditions. I had the other day in Bahrain an opportunity to discuss, I mean, there was somebody else presenting this, and this person said, now we have in a region beside Madrid, we have everything. We don't need to go to Madrid anymore for, you know, receiving tertiary care, which was a big shock to me. I couldn't believe my ears, in the sense that the real development of this system has tended to be based on this overspending towards the creation of, I would not say 17 health systems, but very similar to that. Certainly tertiary care is not anymore an issue that regions are ready to share. All the regions are trying to get their own tertiary care hospitals, or with the exception of a very successful organ transplant unit and program that is running very well in the country. So we will see how Spain accommodates, and how do we define follow-up and evaluation tools that will make the process more transparent. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Antonio. Very interesting, all kinds of data, all kinds of questions. First, however, are there any questions of clarification, specific questions that anyone would like to ask before we move on? Piling up more and more evidence in search of explanatory. No questions. Clarification. Okay. Norway.
Thank you. Norway.
I should start by saying I kept thinking, as Antonio was describing, the differences between the regions in Spain, differences in funding levels, differences in outcome levels, that from a Norwegian perspective, we would be looking at huge inequities between regions, which would set off all kinds of political fireworks, I would think. So there's this, and this is not because Spain is not concerned about equity, but because there are different structural dimensions here. So it's very interesting to juxtapose these two culturally, historically, structurally different systems, and think about what this term decentralization and recentralization mean. Sorry.
Well, thanks. I'm not sure whether you wanted me to speak about why decentralization in Norway is as important as God is, but I'm going to speak about re-centralization anyway. If you paid attention to the one of the slides from Antonio with the numbers on there, you saw that per capita spending in Spain was $2,671, and in Norway it was $4,763. So we are up there with Switzerland, competing for the second place in the how to spend too much money on healthcare, which in a way should perhaps make it easier to run the healthcare system, but surprisingly it's not. I'm going to talk a little bit about why we re-centralized. I'm going to talk about what that means, and I'm going to say a few words about where we might be heading. Are we going back to the good old decentralized days, or are we heading in the direction of even more centralization? Norway, as you may or may not know, it's a small country. So it's 4.7 million people, which basically means it's like Scotland or like one of the English SHAs. So it's a small country, and in Jenny's context, it's important to remember that when you talk about re-centralization and centralization. We have at present a left center left government, which has been in operation for 6 years and have 3 more years to go before they will be probably, if the opinion polls are right, replaced by a moderate right-wing government in 2013. We do have predominantly public provision of services, education, healthcare, social services, and they are predominantly public in the sense that, save the GPs, who are all private GPs, but nobody cares about the GPs, but the hospitals are almost all public. And in Norway, it used to be so that the sense of a private hospital, it was almost immoral to have a private-run hospital. So it's a very long tradition that hospitals should be run by the public sector, which means that how to organize the healthcare sector is both how to organize the publicly provided healthcare goods and also how to provide services for the people, and those two tend to sort of intertwine in one decision. There are 3 levels of political governance. We have the state, which now has the responsibility for the specialized or the secondary healthcare services. We have 19 counties with an average of around 200,000 to 250,000 people in each county. They used to have the responsibility for specialized healthcare services. And we have 430 municipalities, and the median size of a municipality is 5,000. So again, there are a lot of very, very small politically run local governments that has wide powers, actually. The municipalities are responsible for primary health care. And there is, I'll get back to that, there is a reform probably will be implemented next year or the year after that will leave more of the responsibility for the specialized healthcare services to the very, very small municipalities. So that's a little bit of the background. There is a tradition of administrative and political decentralization, but there is a tradition of fiscal centralization. So there are non-discretionary local taxes, 21% on the municipal basis and 7% on the county basis. So municipalities and counties are and wear responsibility for providing a whole range of public services, but they cannot set their taxes freely. So they are dependent on what they get in tax income and also what they get in general purpose grants from the government. And Norway is somewhat different from Finland, Sweden. Well, at least from Sweden and Finland, in the sense that we have a very low share of unconditional central grants. Most of the central grants are conditional. So there is a very high level of fiscal centralization in Norway, which separates us from Finland and Sweden, and also to some sense used to separate us from Denmark, although Denmark's moved more and more in the direction of Norway for the past 5-6 years. So that's the background. I won't give you the full history, but we need to go back to the 80s, where We had a period where the idea of a decentralized healthcare service was very strong in Norway. And the basic idea was that local governments, the counties for the specialized healthcare and the municipalities for the primary healthcare, should be responsible both for the financing and for the provision of healthcare. And there were basically two arguments. One argument was the efficiency argument, which was not, as Richard said, the idea that more units would compete, but it was more the idea that closeness to operational governance, closeness to the unit running, responsible for running the services, would enhance efficiency. It's easier to run a hospital if you're close to the hospital than it is if you're far away from the hospitals. So that was the efficiency argument. And the other argument is that closeness to the people will make the body responsible for the provisional services more receptive to the needs of the population. So the counties were responsible for the hospitals, for the specialized healthcare, and the municipalities for the primary healthcare, and that worked for about 5 years. And then we had a long period where the central government gradually took more and more control over the specialized healthcare services, beginning with the national waiting time guarantee, saying that you should not have to wait more than 6 months in order to get admission to the hospital. There were distributions of tertiary care, saying that transplants should only be done in one hospital, burn treatment should only be done in one hospital. Suddenly there were some extra funding from the central governments for heart surgery or for orthopedic surgery. And then in 1997, we introduced activity-based financing, DRG-based financing, which came from the state to the municipalities, effectively reducing the counties' share of the financing of the healthcare services by 30%. So the state suddenly took over 30% of the financial responsibility for the healthcare, while at the same time, the formal responsibility for running the healthcare services were at the counties. So there was, in some sense, more and more central supervision, less and less local autonomy, more and more local frustration, and probably also more and more central frustration with a system that in many senses didn't seem to work as effectively as was expected. And mainly there were four, perhaps five concerns. First was the low levels of efficiency. The system was perceived to be inefficient in terms of cost efficiency or technical efficiency, whatever. Not allocative efficiency, but cost efficiency. The second concern was that there were large geographical variations in healthcare spending and also large geographical variations in healthcare utilization, which, of course, was to be expected, because when you give the power and responsibility to the counties to run both healthcare, education, and also some road maintenance, and you tell the counties that you can spend the money as you would like to spend the money, some counties will spend a large share of their resources on healthcare, others will spend a large share of their resources on education. So geographical variations were to be expected, but they were suddenly deemed to be a negative aspect of the system. Also, we saw that there were local excess capacity. Most counties would like to have a full share of capacity in most specialties. So there were duplication of services between the counties, and also there were large deficits, and there were a blame game between the hospitals, between the counties and the state, and the state's usual response would be to have soft budgets. So deficits would be covered by the states in the form of extra central funding, sometimes camouflaged as subsidies or whatever, but in essence it was extra central funding from the state to the counties and to the hospitals. But there were, in this period, not that much focus on the primary care. The primary care sector lived its own life outside the scrutiny of the central authorities, but the specialized healthcare sector was sort of the main focus for the reform. So in 2002, we had a re-centralization of the specialist healthcare. The ownership was transferred from the 19 counties to to the state. We had a model that went from devolution to deconcentration. That meant that the hospital sector was organized into five regional health authorities. And the regional health authorities did not have any politicians on the boards. So the regional health authorities would be owned by the state. They would have boards, but the members of the boards would be appointed by the minister. And in the first 2 or 3 years, the minister would try to look as far away from the healthcare sector as possible when he or she appointed members of the board. The less you knew about the healthcare, the better it was. The more of a history you had in the healthcare sector, the more, or the less eligible we are to be a member of that board. But that changed in 4 or 5 years. But you know, the first period, they would look at people from the private sector, from corporations to sit on the board. And the funding of the regional health authorities would be a combination of block grants, adjusted for needs and adjusted for regional cost levels, but also matching activity-based grants, which actually meant that the DRG-based, activity-based financing would also be a financing from the state to the regional health authorities, not only from the regional health authorities to the hospitals, which is, it's very strange, and it's very hard for anybody except the politicians responsible for it to explain why that is so. There has been several of us have tried to argue that. That is not a very good financing method, but it's very hard to get rid of. And the regional health authorities will own the hospitals, which are and will be termed the local health authorities. So that was the reform, and the reform was based on economic goals, as I said, related to cost containment. The idea was that state ownership would end the blame game. One owner, one health policy. So whenever hospitals went into deficits, they wouldn't have the possibility to go to the counties, we could then go to the state. The hospital had to go to regional health authorities and supposedly not get more money, which they actually did, but that's another, I'll get back to that. And the other concern was technical efficiency, again related to economics of scale and economics of scope. And the idea was that with one owner and one health policy, you could have less duplication of services between the counties. And the other main sort of motivation behind the reform was advertised as a management and responsibility reform. The idea was that the state should be the sole owner, but you should also have a more professional management, and you should also have more professional boards. So you should both centralize the responsibilities, centralize the financing, and at the same time increase the level of competence at the managers. So, okay, two adjustments. 4 years into the reform, the composition of the boards was changed so that politicians came back on the boards as members, but this is not elected politicians. These are appointed politicians. So the Minister of Health will appoint members of the board, and he or she will appoint members of the board that are members of the political parties in that represent all the political parties in the region. So it's sort of a way to make the reform seemingly look as it has some sort of local democratic content, which it may or may not have. And there was a further centralization where the number of regional health authorities was reduced from 5 to 4, which means that the largest regional health authority now covers 55% of the population in Norway. Okay. So was this a success or was it not a success? What we saw higher levels of efficiency. We've seen a gradual restructuring. There are larger and more specialized units now than there were 6 or 7 years ago. One interesting point is that before the reform, we had 19 counties responsible for the ownership and running of the hospitals. We had 19 counties and 70 to 80 hospitals. Now we have 20 local health authorities, which are owned by the five regional health authorities. So We now have the same number of local health authorities that we previously had the number of counties. So actually we've sort of re-centralized, and then we merged the old hospitals into new local health authorities that resembles the old counties. There has been a large growth in activity, which has been very much against the explicit policy goals of the government, which means that there has been persistent deficits, and there has been a tradition of soft budgeting, and there has been a tradition of extra funding. Basically, what happens is that the hospital sector will run a deficit. The government will say, oh, too bad, okay, we can cover the deficit, but please, next year, stay within the budget. And next year they will run a deficit, and the central government will say, oops, you did it again, but we'll cover the deficit this year as well, but next year, please stay within the deficit. And this went on for about 6 or 7 years, and actually now we are beginning to see hope that they will stay within the budget limits. So it's sort of a mix between a hospital financing system, which is activity-based, and which sort of generates pressure to increase activity and increase costs, and soft budgeting and bad governance from the central authorities. There has also been a strong focus on regional equity. Okay, so where are we heading? These are the four main policy issues in Norway as they stand now. First, there is a large discussion related to the share of activity-based financing, which at present is 40%. And you guys have 100%. We have 40%. And there is deep concerns within the hospital sector and among many of the politicians that 40% is too high share of activity-based financing. And the basic argument is that they are afraid of selection. So that favorable, that less costly patients will be selected and not the real needy patients. So there is at present a discussion of whether the share of activity-based financing should be reduced from 40 to 30. The second policy issue is the case of central versus local strategic governance, because when the state owns the state is responsible for the strategic governance, which frustrates a lot of the local municipalities and also a lot of the county councils, and strangely enough, also some of the ministers in the government are frustrated by this. So there's an ongoing debate about who should be responsible for governing the sector. There is a lack of integration between primary and secondary care, and increasingly questions are raised about whether we really need four regional health authorities or whether the 20 local health authorities is enough. So what we might see in the future is we might see an abolishment of the regional health authorities in favor of a central health directorate, which would imply a more NHS-like organization. But those in favor of abolishing the regional health authorities are fuzzy about whether we need some sort of UK-like strategic health authorities or whether we should have a financing directly from the state to the local health authorities. We might see a reduction in the activity-based financing, as I said, from 40 to 30%. We have an interaction reform or a coordination reform, or whatever you want to call it, which essentially means that we are trying to copy what the Danes are doing, and that is allocating 20% of the budget for specialized healthcare services to the municipalities and asking the municipalities to pay for hospital services. And those of you who have worked with the resource allocation formulas in the UK, you know that allocating needs adjusted money to municipalities of 5,000 inhabitants is a very risky procedure. So there is a debate, ongoing debate about that now. So the main dilemma, just to sum up, the main dilemma as I see it from the Norwegian perspective is that devolution, almost by definition, devolution implies geographical variations. And in Norway, geographical variations are more or less politically unacceptable. On the other hand, deconcentration or centralization with some sort of administrative decentralization implies a lack of local political control, which is very hard for the local politicians to accept when the decisions are unfavorable for them. So what most local politicians want is to have the cake and eat it too. They want to be able to decide what services are to be provided at what hospital and where the hospital should be located. But at the same time, they need to be reassured that they will get exactly the same amount of money as the neighboring municipality or as the neighboring regional health authority. So that's sort of the dilemma and where we are going to move away from that one, I'm not sure. Probably we will strengthen the role of the municipalities. Probably we will remove the regional health authority level. But that's really guessing more than it is a sound prediction. Okay. Thanks.
Thank you, John. I stirred the pot further in terms of what's happening. Sounds like more and less re-centralization at the same time coming from our way. Okay. With the responsibility of bringing all this home and fitting theory to fact, Scott Greer with the UK and
I try to avoid using PowerPoint. I'm also dealing with the after effects of a head cold, so if I have a coughing fit or talk funny, please be indulgent. I'll also use that excuse if I say something really stupid. I'm going to try looking at the United Kingdom in comparative perspective. Now, as Richard said, there's a lot of different ways to slice up what is decentralization. If you give us long enough, we can construct some definition of decentralization that we can correlate with anything. You know, rate at which bees die. We could probably eventually construct a definition of decentralization that would give you the same set of countries. And that means that it's always hard to talk about it, you know. If you have partial elections to a Scottish health board, is that decentralization? If you hand over some aspects of public health to local government in England, is that decentralization? But I'm going to go for one of the bigger and sturdier definitions that survived pretty well around the world, which is the distinction between political devolution and administrative devolution. They occasionally get confused, particularly in England. It's been fun tracking different secretaries of state who sometimes say devolution when they mean foundation hospitals and sometimes say devolution when they mean Scotland. And it's noticeable that civil servants tend to be the ones who catch them and say, no, 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 the usage is that devolution means Scotland and you have to come up with some other word when you want to talk about foundation hospitals. What those secretaries of state are being taught by their civil servants is essentially the distinction between administrative and political devolution, administrative and political decentralization. Political decentralization is basically about big elected general purpose governments, governments with real politicians in real elections managing something that looks like a real budget. By and large, they are their own masters. They are constrained and entangled with other levels of government in all sorts of different ways. But these are real governments, and they carry themselves like it. They're the German Länder. They're the Spanish Comunidades Autónomas. They're Scotland. They're Wales. You can laugh at them. You can dislike them. But they're a far cry from the sorts of units that we see in administrative devolution, which are essentially various mechanisms for operating what government does. And these are playthings of whatever government sponsors them. Look at the history of English regions. English regional boards in 1980, reorganized, reorganized again, reorganized into units in the management executive, reorganized out of existence, immediately replaced with something called regional directors of health and social care, who were reorganized out of existence to be replaced with SHAs, which were reorganized and which are now apparently on the block entirely. If you tried doing that with Scotland, you would have a constitutional crisis and the United Kingdom would lose about the northern 40% of its territory within a year or so if Westminster tried to treat Scotland in that manner. That's the difference between administrative and political decentralization. Political decentralization is big governments with fungible budgets and real politicians. Administered decentralization is essentially about the territorial organization, who has autonomy, at what level within the English NHS. Who is responsible for what patch of turf within the English NHS? And it is typically the plaything of politicians, as the case of regions in the English NHS tells you. Now, Over time, political decentralization has been a very broadly shared, more or less unidirectional trend in Europe. I have to query that because political decentralization is also, as particularly Antonio said, expensive. So when we really see the budgetary consequences of the last 2 years' worth of economic mayhem, the unidirectional trend towards political decentralization might not, we might go into reverse. It's certainly likely to slow down. Administrative decentralization is all over the map because it lasts as long as any given minister's theory of public administration. Now, when you look at the United Kingdom, it's a really interesting case comparatively because you have completely different things going on whether you're looking at political or administrative decentralization. In terms of political, crudely put, in terms of political decentralization, the United Kingdom is a real European, if not global, leader for creating strong and autonomous regional governments. Administratively, within England, you also have a sort of fascinating and quite internationally rare case of a government that just really systematically across elections doesn't like intermediate territorial units, just doesn't like regions, doesn't like local things. So you have this intense centralization administratively and this equally impressive political decentralization. That's what I'm going to talk about. How did the United Kingdom get in, or what is, are the consequences of the fact that the United Kingdom has basically got a politics of nations, not a politics of regions or territory? Well, the first point I want to make is that it's got the support of the population. We poll extensively on this. We polled in the form of referenda in the devolveds and also in the northeast of England. And we also poll constantly in ordinary public opinion. What we find is consistent. In Northern Ireland and Wales, they like devolution and they like it more every year. In Scotland, they always liked devolution and they like it a little bit more every year. They're starting from a higher base. The English have essentially no interest in being regionalized, and they have an affection for local units, but that doesn't really stray over into any affection for local governments or local NHS organizations. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. You know, hands up if you didn't know that the Scots are somewhat nationalist and the English are a bit skeptical about their local government. Thank you. So, with that support of the population, what we've seen is, first of all, intense political devolution since 1998. Now, this built on a legacy of the longest-lasting and most solid administrative devolution in the UK, which was the old Scottish office, the old Welsh office, and the old Northern Ireland office, each of which was essentially a mini Whitehall. If you went up to Edinburgh, you could find a little Scottish education department and a little Scottish health department and a little Scottish agricultural department that didn't really have that much to do with London. They also didn't have that much autonomy or policy capacity. Atop that administrative devolution that had existed since the 19th century in the case of Scotland and Ireland, we plunked down parliaments, elected by the very different Scottish, Welsh, and Northern Ireland political systems, which have only incidental and somewhat complicated connections with the United Kingdom party system as a whole. For example, the Conservatives don't matter. And the SNP is a problem that Labour has in Scotland and obviously doesn't have to deal with in England. What was the framework that we put down on these undoubtedly nationalism-driven creations? First of all, governments really control three things, right? Their power comes from having money, laws, and resources such as people. In money, the United Kingdom has a unique international funding mechanism called the Barnett Formula, which is carefully designed in order to make everybody dislike it. Really, every other nation has, you know, every other system has somebody where you can say they're winning. The United Kingdom's is quite exquisitely balanced to make everybody a little bit grumpy about what's going on. The Barnett Formula essentially amounts to a block fund given to Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. They can spend it as they like. Whitehall doesn't have the ability to earmark funds and say, we'll give you a little bit of extra money if you agree to spend it on cancer care or something. Equivalently, there's almost no obligation on Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland as to how they're supposed to spend it. So they take a large block of money from the Exchequer, and the check on what they're going to do with it is their own local voters. It's not the business of English taxpayers what the Scots do with the money. If the Scots misspend the money or they get the balance between health and education wrong, they're accountable to the Scottish electorate. What this produces is a really strikingly high level of autonomy. You just don't really have that much fiscal power over the devolveds if you're sitting in Whitehall. You don't have any good monetary ways to tug at them and influence them. You also have this crazy formula, which, as I mentioned, is attempting to increase the share of per capita finance in England over time, decrease the share of per capita finance to the devolveds. This is brilliant because the Welsh are underfunded relative to most indicators of need, and they're going to get less money. The Scots are astronomically overfunded relative to most things, and they're going to get less money, but if you don't think they're overfunded, then that's bad. The English are underfunded relative to the devolveds, but the amount of new money into England is going to take so long to feed through that nobody's ever going to notice it. That's why, in a sense, the Barnett formula is designed to be structurally offensive. And it works. But it gives you a lot of devolved autonomy. Then there's laws. This is a wonderful thicket for lawyers. If you know any law students looking for something to write about, I strongly recommend it. I'll just say Scotland is basically as good as a government in the areas it's got power, which emphatically includes health. Wales is almost as good as a government. It's as good as a really strong Secretary of State because they can control secondary legislation, which is essentially the highest legal form known in most NHS organizations. Northern Ireland is as good as Scotland, but it's okay because they're incapable of self-government. I can't make decisions, so the extent of their powers is not that relevant. And finally, resources. Who do they employ? Scottish civil service is good, and there is no Department of Health effectively in Scotland. Welsh civil service is getting better. Again, there's effectively no Department of Health. Whitehall doesn't even know what's going on there. There's nobody on the ground. If they're going to go talk to the Scots, they've got to get on the train and visit. I've called this elsewhere a fragile divergence machine. It's really perfectly calculated to create divergence. You have four very different political systems. The budgets are insulated from each other. The media don't necessarily communicate as much as you would think. And they all have more or less infinite ability to play with the organization of the NHS, which they do. That's why it's a divergence machine. It's fragile because the Barnett formula that I've talked about so much is essentially a spreadsheet in the Treasury. It could be changed tomorrow. The day you want to take on the Scots and the day you want to think of a better replacement is the day you can do it, Chancellor Osborne. And you don't have to apologize to anybody. So it's fragile, it's exciting, and it's created some very strong political devolution with big health service consequences. And I'll restrain my temptation to do what I've been doing for the last 10 years and talk excitedly about all the different things happening in the four units. Instead, let's go to England, which, let me remind you of one fact. About 52 million people live in England. So we're talking about, by rich country standards, a really big unit, bigger than California, bigger than practically every country in the European Union. So with that baseline, we're talking about 52 million people. We're talking about something really ambitious in any before any policy is tried. We then come to grips with a frankly breathtaking policy agenda, which is the centralization of England. The really quite dramatic pattern since, take your pick, possibly 1974 or 1982, but definitely since 1989, the slow destruction of intermediate to territorial levels in the NHS. And as a party trick, I can try and recite all the different ones I can think of that have been abolished, but we can just pick PCTs and SHAs as the most recent two intermediate territorial levels that are essentially on the block. You can see it if you make a map of the organization of the English NHS since 1948. You start off and you achieve the apotheosis of intermediate levels in 1974 when you have this incredibly long ladder of different, you know, what's the difference between a DHA and an FHA, sort of, all these ancient questions of theology. And ever since then, it's been getting shorter and shorter, narrowing down to the world that Lansley has promised us, in which the regulators, the board, the commissioning board, and the Secretary of State will essentially be eyeball to eyeball with the rabble of GPs and foundation trusts, with no intermediate boards to confuse things or diffuse responsibility. Now, this destruction of territorial levels, destruction sounds a bit hard. I don't know why you necessarily want to have any given set of territorial levels, really stands out internationally, because normally if you have 52 million people, you have political and administrative devolution. What seems to be driving this over many different governments, many different theories, with really remarkably few counterexamples? I'd say there's at least three you can think of. One is where the Secretary of State gets dragged into something, nobody likes it, and they try to come up with some more competent and more hands-off way to deal with it. This tends to be the origins of regulators. This tends to be the origin of NICE, Care Quality Commission, a whole lot of arm's-length bodies that have come and gone. This is kind of classically when some poor Secretary of State gets it in his or her head to intervene in something local, hates the experience, and says, I'd like to have somebody who can consistently keep the pressure on, give transparent rules, and get everyone to behave. That's fine. That might or might not get the Secretary of State out of the problem. But what it's left behind is centralization. Take NICE. Pre-NICE, you had a sort of random pattern where you pay for something and you don't. Post-NICE, there's at least the architecture to say everybody should get something. Instead of what was previously just a weird kind of random-looking territorial variation, you now have, at least in principle, a national policy. The Daily Mail really appreciates this because, frankly, you don't sell a lot of papers by lighting out after whatever organization pays for healthcare in Hull in a given year. But if you can go after NICE, that's always good on a slow news day. So, you know, the Daily Mail at least can appreciate the virtues of this. Now, a second one is nice and simple, which is, if I've got an idea and I think I know how to fix healthcare, what's more fun for me? To go tramping around my local PCT and see if I sit through enough meetings I can get some money for a pilot? Or to get the train for London? Take my idea and sell it in the halls of power. Try to persuade somebody in the Department of Health that this is a good idea. Try to persuade the health committee that maybe they should mention it in a report. Try to nobble some special advisor. Don't forget that. Policy entrepreneurs are not stupid. They shoot where the ducks are. And the third one is very simple, which is that we've been trying to build, and the whole world's watching, a market in England since 1989. Now, if you have a market, if you have a functioning purchaser-provider split of some description, such as the one the coalition is trying to create, what exactly is the point of a regional unit? If all the trusts are foundation trusts, and all the commissioning is done by collectives of GPs, and the collectivization process has not led to too many disasters, what exactly would an SHA do? Well, of course, we'll abolish them. And that's been the logic you've seen a lot since 1989. You create some description of market mechanism, the original purchaser-provider split, or the commissioning mechanisms under labor, or the new one, and you say, well, QED, I don't need the regional level, I'll get rid of it. I don't need multiple local levels, I'll get rid of them. These are at least three different mechanisms that produce the centralization, the general trend that we often see in England, against the backdrop of the fact that if you ask English voters whether they'd rather have a powerful northeastern regional assembly, they say absolutely not. Now, what are the effects? In general, I hope you've got from all of us that you should be agnostic about it. Decentralization works about as well as decentralization works in any given country. Decentralized Spain works about as well as Spain works. Decentralized United States works about as well as the United States works. Decentralized Nigeria is exactly as corrupt and stinky as centralized Nigeria was. That's basically the international finding. But I want to leave you with a question. There's a lot of intellectual academic questions. why don't the English like their local government much is kind of an interesting thing for us to noodle about at the Political Studies Association. But the really big one is, you've got to get to a place like China to find somebody trying to run a 52 million person thing for the delivery of health services. This is 10 times larger than the average size of the region of the units that are responsible for delivering healthcare in most of the rest of the world. England is really big and is conducting this 20-odd year experiment in seeing just how centralized you can get. Intellectually fascinating. Can it work? Thank you.
Okay. I was about to say new challenges, but not to this audience. All right, we have kept close to 30 minutes for questions, comments, and not just because Scott dealt with the UK. Also, we have looked at statements of outrage about the lack of development of centralization and decentralization theory. Other perspectives, particularly from the framework or the point of view of those of you who have to live inside these structures in terms of how they influence their decisions. We have been gloriously imprecise today in terms of how we've assessed the relative balance of decentralization, centralization, the extent to which one is a better approach than another, both from a conceptual point of view in the beginning, from Jenny and I, right to Scott's challenge about whether or not a centralized, well, if it is indeed centralized, that's another whole set of questions, but a centralized market, which is itself a contradiction, is an appropriate model for 52 million people. Do you have questions for any of us? Thoughts about how this adds up? Issues that you would like to see discussed that we have not dealt with? So, no questions.
I think we've really covered an issue that is one of the reasons why the Daily Mail like mine, which is that what does the public expect in terms of local sensitivity, which they're fond of, but also everybody getting the same, with the postcode lottery, as it's sometimes called. So I want to have the best services, I want to have the best services, and they ought to all be the same, and they ought to be local sensitive. So this is, I think that sets...
Are you pushing on the idea that you have to centralise?
I'm just wondering what we know about, what the public, to some extent politicians are putting these systems, to some extent they're putting these systems in place in response to what they think provides the voting public and the use of services with what they want. So what the public believe here might be quite important. I think one of the things that that politicians in the UK have wrestled with is this kind of almost mutually contradictory set of views that the public hold at the same time, which is they want locally sensitive services and they want everything to be the same everywhere. I'd like to just understand what's happening in different countries and whether this problem that the UK suffers from is I think that's one thing that at some point I want to come back and just say something about what the 52 running 52 million system centrally. I have some views on that.
Are you catching ideas or
I'm sorry?
The thing I would think would be interesting is about the political mix. So I'm, a mere administrator in this administrative decentralisation, and I would characterise working in Conservative and Labour governments very differently, so that their political, I perceive their political motivations about decentralisation or centralisation to be completely different. So whilst I bought your analysis, I could play a different sort of analysis around political influence, around centralised and decentralised approaches. So I just think that's quite interesting about, because you were saying in Spain it didn't work, and I'm just quite interested in, there's lots of different, there must be lots of cultural and historical reasons which cause governments to go one way or another, and you know, the strength of the lender in Germany or whatever, but I'm just quite interested in some of those political plays.
You're coming back to this notion that the decision making about centralization or decentralization is ultimately a political decision, and if the political split is such, and it depends on the country, that there are different views amongst the dominant, in this case the two dominant parties, then what you're wondering about is whether that takes predominance over all of these sort of rarefied
the fact you were saying is that everyone can argue either centralization or decentralization. I think my analysis would be that the political drivers lead them to then say, well, we'll centralize or we'll decentralize, not because they're intrinsically interested in centralization or decentralization, but they're interested in their higher political. So the Labour Party wanted to establish very clearly that there was one NHS and it was the same for everyone, and you had to go around and use the same logo the whole time, and that led to a huge amount of centralization. We had the plan and targets, etc., etc. That wasn't because they thought centralization was right, that's because they wanted their political dump. When the Conservatives are going to go around creating mayhem, but they, it's essentially, actually I think quite a lot about decentralising. Actually, I mean, decentralisation is a huge amount of decentralisation because they think that local determinism and local sensitivity and a bit of market makes a difference, and therefore they will have a lot of administratively a lot of decentralisation. But it's not because they have a political view about centralisation.
So it's not a question of efficiency, it's not a question of some broader truth that we can find, it's actually the notion that these are just two political tools, they're devices,
ideology. You academics actually worry about these things rather than
But that's the point, which I think is very interesting. What you're saying is practically from the ground, you're seeing that these are just justifications. These are not independent, self-standing structures. Other points, questions? We'll put them all on the table and then we'll see if our panelists can solve them.
The thesis was that what we're looking at now in the UK is that there's a lot of centralization. And is that actually the case? I mean, we're going to have a large number of these GPCCs. And is that not also an example of massive decentralization? And some interesting thoughts about that, which I have interesting views on, which is the form of these GPCCs doesn't have any political content to it. It's a matter of merely for the convenience, maybe that's a slightly stronger word, but to an element of this is the convenience of local GPs, who do they like to work with. So there isn't a political context within which local population can see any sort of local base for them. I'm also interested, we haven't talked much about rationing and how demand management is done, and how that fits within something which is now becoming really, you know, if you've got this large number of very, very small units, how you can start administering that in a political context effectively.
Judge, can I say something about that? That's a very important point. The new system in England represents a shift from centralised power held by governments based on some kind of democratic theory that occasionally from time to time you vote for the Secretary of State, and that's how we hold the system to account. The system actually, where legitimacy comes from, GPs see 70% of their population every year, and it's based on individuals and professional judgment and based on personal contact, not on populations, and there's going to be, I think, a very interesting collision when that bumps into local government. But I just want to make one other point, if I may, which comes back to the point. No one's really, when they talk about decentralisation, talks about scale. I think this matters because Kaiser works quite nicely with 8 million members. The VA is very big. But I think there comes a point where the marginal benefits of increased size are wiped out by the disbenefits of increased complexity. And therefore, what you mean by decentralisation and what you're decentralising to matters. So it's too small, it's certainly not going to work at all, and it hasn't. The original Conservative plan was to actually devolve budgets to practices. You can't actually make any sensible statements about they're too small, there's too much variation, so they had to come up a level. But at the level of 52 million, any advantage you got from scale is wiped out by complexity. So you made one small mistake, a small decimal point mistake in a contract for general practitioners turns out to be several hundred million pounds.
So the
chance of making a mistake becomes very much higher because you've now got a system that's too complex, too diverse to be actually. So I think
you raise the question about how big is too big.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Whereas we also have for real, how small is too small.
Yeah.
Yes. Which suggests that
so Northern Ireland is very struggling.
It's very size sensitive.
Yeah. And made worse by the possibility that because we're asking these institutions to do multiple tasks, there may not be a right size. And this is the story of the reorganisation of the primary care trusts and the health focuses in England. There's a constant search for the optimal size of organisation, when in fact the truth was obvious to those who worked in it, that they were, at one level, they might be too big, they'd be too small to talk to large hospitals about
right.
things that large hospitals do.
Right.
And if you got big enough to be able to talk to large hospitals, they were too
depends
big to talk to general
practitioners. Depends on the function.
Yeah,
different sizes for different functions.
And the kind of, because of a sort of political search for neatness, which seems to have, I don't think this is a feature of other systems, which is that we must get it right. And actually, the NHS managers are complicit in this whole set of rewards and incentives for reorganisation, particularly if you're over 50. To do the pension arrangements.
Well, if you call different needs, I would suggest also the question of accountability. You could have different needs and require different levels to deal with, but then how in heaven's name can you make those different entities are all accountable in some reasonable way. So the accountability structure requires you to set and decide either something small or something larger. Scott's raised the question of whether 52 million might be even too large, but obviously that reflects a whole set of cultural and many of which you raised. I mean, from a political science perspective, there's a whole historical and cultural context here. Sorry, give one more point.
That was it.
Okay, sir.
First of all, thank you for a very interesting presentation. Back to the point that you mentioned about allocative efficiency versus cost efficiency. And it's not the first time we've heard that. New Parliament has been fueling that for a long time. but when I was hearing that, you talked about meeting local meeting local need versus benefits of aggregation. What I wrote in the panel was Lansley versus Lansley. So on one side is saying you need to meet local need and give GPs that purchasing power because they're making the institution closer to the patients. Yet at the same time we need to put management costs and we need to improve sort of cost efficiency side of things. So I put Lansley versus Lansley on the card and I conclude with sort of dogs dinner. It's not really played very well in liberating the NHS. That was point one. Point two was where is the sort of the democratic deficit issue in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So for the past sort of 10 years, the Lib Dems especially have been pushing this issue. And on one hand, the shift towards sort of, locally elected health boards or locally elected patient representatives onto PCT boards, as per their manifesto, was maybe a shift towards trying to address that democratic deficit. Yet at the same time, at the European level, we've seen an increased Europeanisation of sort of health policy in this country. Some may argue that with the European Union there's a focus on political integration, economic integration, and once the EU run out of things to focus on, they've shifted over onto social integration. So, therefore, on one hand, we've got this democracy deficit issue, and then the Europeanisation on the other hand. So, it's just a second question.
If I could rephrase that, you're asking this a question about where on the centralisation, decentralisation framework do you see a democratic or democracy deficit? Does that imply that centralization is not democratic? At what point? I mean, if you have elected governments inside the UK, obviously that's different. You get to the level of the European Union, then we are talking about something that has been described at great length as a democracy deficit, although there are still members of the European Parliament and still mechanisms. So one of the questions that gets involved here is, not only is efficiency a fungible category, depending on how you're interpreting things from decentralized to centralized, you know, smaller or larger units, if you will, making decisions, But the question is whether democratic decision making is a valid way of understanding it, or is
it something entirely separate? I can imagine. I mean,
the original design
of the GP commissioning scheme that Landry Lansley wanted to put in place had no public engagement in it whatsoever. I don't know what the theory was. I think I'm sure that GPs would have looked to having patient representatives, but there was virtually no mechanism for accountability to local people, despite the fact it was a highly devolved decentralised system. About the only thing that you could have had, you might have been able to say at the end of your GP consultation, well, it was actually one other thing, doctor, I'd like to talk to you about your strategy for asthma. but there was no other way, particularly, of engaging with these groups.
I'm just making the point. Yeah.
I can envisage a highly decentralised system that has no democratic component in it at all. So I think actually it's not that helpful.
I always talk about the legitimacy of the strategy.
Yeah.
So there's a question of how one cuts up this concept of democracy and how one applies it, and what does that mean about, and in this case, into this whole,
There's only one way of holding these organisations together. You could imagine another model in which you simply Dutch style. If you don't like it, you change. You subscribe to it. So there is you can have decentralisation or centralisation with either voice or with exit. And I think it's not.
Think about the Norwegian example. They had fully democratic, regionally elected counties that ran the healthcare system, which ran into a sufficient problem that the national government pulled it away. But you then argue that in a country of 4.7 million, the national government doesn't have democratic legitimacy. I mean, we're talking about different levels of democracy. We have to have subcategories here. The democracy issue is interesting that this is this legitimation or accountability issue is so important. I would have thought that in the current context, the cost issue and the finance and the budgeting issue would have attracted more attention in the UK, but I suppose they wouldn't. Other comments, questions, issues to put on the floor? I'm going to ask our panelists.
I was going to ask a slightly different question.
Sir.
That's the question of whether or not we might achieve a decentralisation. I don't think it's a question of either or, for example. I think we could have both in a relationship with a healthcare system. But that aside, I wonder if we're going to achieve decentralisation by the back door. And I wonder to what extent the privatisation of healthcare services in the future is going to expand. And we might find ourselves in a situation where we have always by default suddenly realised that we've decentralised our systems. And when we have in the UK, as you know, we're about to privatise our first district general hospital in the shape of Vinci Hospital. All sorts of rumours about a whole host of other failing hospitals which are then going to be privatised. So I'd be interested to just see what your views are on that.
Can I ask one technical question? Sorry. A question of clarification from the chair. When you say privatised, does that mean that management will be given over to the private sector? So
yes.
The management, you're not actually selling the institution off. Lock, stock, and buildings to the private sector.
No, but they're
right. So it's private management on a contract basis.
Yes.
Okay. Because I would not use that word to describe that as being privatized, but in the UK, that word privatization can mean many things. All right. We have a lot of issues already. Are there any others that come to mind? For the complicated discussion, sir.
Just building on the democratization issue. I'm quite curious to know, I think one very first slide, John's slide, talked about the idea of closer to the people. That decentralization brings it closer to people. And I'm interested, what difference is there that actually that has any results? Particularly on that administrative side, that administrative facet. I'm not sure that there is evidence. I mean, if there is, I think.
And does that evidence depend on something other than just the mere fact that it's been done? In other words, this issue of trust that Antonio raised, is it something about size and structure, the way that it would influence Norway? I mean, is there some other factors?
Well, that's what I'm curious to know about.
Yeah. And do we know? That's a question for Scott. Anything else? for the moment. Others, we have a very rich set of issues to choose from. Who would like to step in first? Antonio, you can ask. Go ahead.
A year ago, something like this, the Chinese government sent to Europe a group of people to study what to do after their privatization. They were worried about a number of things and they wanted to study this. And I remember this conversation with them, because they went to Geneva and then to Copenhagen, and they came to Spain. And one of them was complaining that he had a very small region. The others were happier because they had a partial region. But this one was very unhappy because he only had 85 million people in the region. And then I realized that things are relative. My concern is that it's not by chance that we have been imprecise. It's not by design. It's not by design that we see centralizing tensions and decentralizing tension and what Alan Maynard called the re-disorganization of the deck chairs of the Titanic in many of these collections. What I believe, and I think it's a very abstract discussion, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but I want to express it, is that the discussion in Spain, for example, between centralization and decentralization is essentially a fake discussion. It's a fake discussion because it assumes that the order of things, the nature of the issues, is homogeneous and you can delegate it in a compact way with all the pros and all the cons. And what we are seeing in the world is the appearance of a number of processes that are very complex and that make it look more like a very, very, very unhomogeneous pack in which you cannot transfer some things without incurring in tremendous difficulties. And I will try to explain what I mean. Take, for example, size. Economies of scale are applicable to different orders of magnitude. The things that are really important at the thousands are meaningless at the level of the millions and the other way around. Legal issues. You have in Spain a number of things that are related to the European Union that are above, very much above, even the national sovereignty. I mean, look at these health technology assessment offices. It's a ridiculous thing. Well, a health technology office in Andalusia or in Catalonia, it's called with Siemens, is just an idiotic thing. Because, I mean, these people are doing their research and their lobbying and whatever at the level, at a completely different level. The same with labor legislation. The same at decision making and the availability of information. So what I believe is that the issue of decentralization and centralization is somehow the very issue of public and private, the definition of public and private, is reflecting some discomfort, some deep discomfort with the way things are and the understanding that new arrangements are needed, but not, I mean, we don't have the solutions yet. We know that for certain things, as was very well expressed by you, you can wipe out a lot of intermediary things that from many points of view could be called completely parasitic and meaningless. Whereas others of probably even smaller size are, in other words, policy scientists or whatever are calling these the discussion of governance versus government and all these new tensions in society, etc. And I'm convinced that the example of Spain, the example of Norway, reveals very well that if you want to use these examples, as you could, for example, discuss the Spanish Empire versus the English or the British Empire, as the way you run it with vice kings or no vice kings, with this, you cannot do it anymore because this is not the magnitude that we're talking about. Societies are not homogeneous as they used to be, processes are not the same, and the scope and the size and the mechanisms are different. And we are using the wrong tools. We're using tools that are supposed to capture the balance of power and the balance of administration, but there are many other phenomena that cannot be captured with those tools. We are missing the issue of democracy, we are missing the issue of efficiency, we are missing the issue of accountability, we are missing the issue of ethics in professional practice, etc. And in summary, I don't have the solution, but we need to think that sooner than later, we need to address these from a different set of parameters. That will be my conclusion.
There's a broader framework that has to be accommodated.
Exactly.
John, did you want to address some of these?
3 points. First point, I usually come out of these decentralization meetings more confused than I am. And also today. The second point is that from the Norwegian perspective, I think what we've learned is that a system that is fiscally centralized and politically decentralized does not work well. So if the decentralized units are able to make decisions that shift the cost over to the central states, then you have a bad model. So that's the essential lesson from the regional. And the third point is that after re-centralizing, after placing the fiscal and political decisions at the same level, what fascinates me is that the political discussion is not about how to provide equal healthcare services to the population, but the discussion is about who does what where. So it's a question of organizing the delivery system. It's not a question about how to get good healthcare systems. It's about which community, which municipality, which part of the country gets the largest hospital and who does not get it.
That's not new.
No, and it's also...
So it's the same debate.
It's the same debate. And it's
about
also,
carving up
and it's
public
also,
resources.
It's also a Scandinavian debate. Because it's, I mean, it's the same Denmark, Sweden, and also Finland.
So, Jenny.
Which leads me nicely to my main point, which is that a lot of these debates are massively culturally dependent. Because if you have a conversation with someone in Sweden about healthcare, for them to pull out local democracy and local politicians and local political leadership in that conversation would be unthinkable. It's just like, why on earth would you think like that? So lots of this about where we are, where things are moving, is about where people come from and what their sense of public space is, private space, and their kind of their history of democracy. So it's not, and I think we need to keep that in mind when we think about this. It's not a kind of holy grail of if we could figure out the right unit of size, it would apply to the other countries. I'm not sure what that's true. I think it's about where the countries come from and where it's at in Latvia and some of the other countries. So really good examples of that, where you just don't have the infrastructure in place for the political and fiscal segregation down. So it's not about decentralisation is good or bad. It's just you didn't have what was needed there at the time. And I agree with Antonio, I think we need a much more nuanced discussion and debate about what needs to happen. And I mean, I think what's happening in England is really, really interesting. Quite scary, I think, potentially. I think for me, looking at it, just the lack of accountability looks huge. And the sort of giving billions of budget to people who don't actually work for you. I don't know if that I need to sit in line with that because you took straight to it.
One point that what Jenny just discussed raises in my mind is the reality in a number of countries. Latvia on the one extreme, Sweden on the other, in terms of infrastructure, that health is not the only thing within the public sector. That health in Sweden is organized in the public sector a little bit differently because of the way the regions, or the structure of the regions, but for example, if you look at other responsibilities in the public sector in these countries, they have, in Finland, for example, the municipal level is responsible for education, it's responsible for housing, it's responsible for childcare, it's responsible for highways. is responsible for a whole variety of services, so that infrastructure is built up, and then health is merely one part. So this issue about decentralizing in Finland is not just an issue about an abstract concept in the health sector about which is better based on some notions of preference about equity or accountability or democratic closeness. It's tied to the existing function that's already in place, institutional capacity, I guess is what we have to say here. And what you're suggesting about Latvia or about Estonia, which has done some very interesting things, but in those countries, they're redoing their institutional capacity. They are restructuring it,
yeah.
So they have more openness. Then the question for England becomes, how does the institutional capacity for dealing with health differ from the institutional capacity for education, institutional capacity for welfare, institutional capacity for housing, and what does that mean? Granted that in this case we're talking about 52 million people rather than 4.7, or in the case of Sweden, 9.2 million. Scott, did you have some final thoughts on that?
I just had, yeah, but I mean, I actually also want to answer 2 points that came up quickly.
Please.
Imagine, from the country where I know the public opinion, it is child's play to construct a survey that gets 90% support for having everything be equal and 90% support for diversity. I think the way to put it is, how easy and how frequently is it mobilized? What's more likely, that the Daily Mail is going to go crazy on one point or another, you know, that there's not enough local diversity, that's not economically what a national newspaper is going to be played by?
Oh no, the Daily Mail has it either which way now. I think it's a postcode lottery.
Exactly.
Or they can do one size fits all, that can't be right. Daily Mail's get print papers every day. It's,
I think the impression that all policy in England revolves around what the Daily Mail.
Unfortunately.
There seem to be some countries. England seems to be a country where it's most frequently mobilized in favor of uniformity. There seem to be some countries that are just more relaxed. Americans, Canadians seem to be much more willing to tolerate the idea that if you're in Mississippi, you're functionally in a third world country.
Not anymore, Scott. You need to go visit Mississippi. I know you're from the northwest, I guess, which is different.
Numeracy, nutrition, health.
They now have large numbers of automobile factories with actually higher wages than
we resent that.
Michigan, where you are living. That's another different discussion.
But if I could just interrupt, I think that goes back to the interesting question as to why, as a nation, we don't think local government should run the health service.
Well, what about the education service? What about the housing service? That's the point.
They've had a lot of their power eroded over the last 20 years.
I mean,
that's huge infrastructure.
It seems to me your touchstone may not be the Daily Mail, but maybe Henry VIII or something. I mean, that, centralized and centrally controlled, and that it's still logically processed that way in a cultural and historic. I'm picking just one avatar you can pick another.
Let's hear your second point.
Well, no, I think you're right that this stuff is all instrumental. I mean, the only people who really care deeply about the allocation of power tend to be nationalists, and they tend to care about political devolution to whatever it is they like, and sometimes they want to be devolved all the way to independence. So, in a sense, if we're talking about administration, that's fine. You know, if it doesn't work, fix it. Be instrumental about it. But otherwise, you get people who get very wound up about something, and a lot of the time it's actually just a covert policy position that they take. And I think the other point just is, one of the things that's on the democracy thing, Nigel mentioned exit voice, i.e., what do I do if I don't like the service I'm getting? Do I, A, vote, exercise some democratic accountability, or B, do I walk out? If I don't like my news agent, I'll go find another news agent. If I don't like my local government, I just have to vote for somebody different. And if nothing else, because if you have 52 million people, democratic accountability is not conceptually easy to handle. Who exactly gets to complain to the Secretary of State personally and exercise their accountability out of 52 million people? So there's this kind of a natural tendency, if you're not going to think about local democratic political devolution, there is this tendency to say, all right then, folks, it's the market. Let's try and find a way to give somebody the sovereignty of a consumer in order to make the system work. And most of the time when you do that, be it in telecommunications, healthcare, what you tend to get is a world organized around extremely strong statutory regulators, the Ofcoms of the world. And I think it's a little early to say what will become of Lansley, but if I were looking for a job right now, I'd be thinking Monitor looks good.
Okay. Unfortunately, we are over time. I understand.
But fortunately, there is one
outside. That's what I was going to say. So there's a venue to continue the discussion. I think we've touched on many different areas and some very interesting, some things that have already been done in the research world, some things that perhaps need to be done in the research world. What keeps coming through, as Jenny has said, and is inherent in the clash of perspectives that's been going on amongst the presenters, is the divergence. Some extent, why divergence and how this discussion of centralization, decentralization is interpreted across countries. The issue of context, the issue of national norms, values, culture, the issue of institutional capacity, institutional expectations, issues of size, and also issues of political expectations. Which isn't to say that there are no ways of judging or assessing the differences between decentralization or centralization, but that the process is going to differ from place to place. And then the question becomes, how then you define those places? Is it national government, regional, is it local? We get into that whole discussion. So, I guess thank you all very much. Very interesting. Hopefully we'll continue now over libation. Thank you.
There was one slide I couldn't quite read because of where I was. It went by very quickly. That was all.
What was it, Nigel?
It's this one here. It's okay. No, it's not numbers. It was this slide here. I was just thinking about something else, and it came in this way. It's quite a complex set. Well, that's what's happened in Wales. You devolve down, and the people who devolve go, I've got my hands on the power.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what Scotland has done the same.
Yeah.
So the power gets sacked up, paradoxically.
Yeah.
It stops at the next level down.
Yeah.
We had the thing shifting the balance of power. My joke was that it shifted to John Bacon, which is one level down, and then immediately grabbed all the levers and started.
Is it last nationalised industry?
Yeah. First of all, where can we strengthen the links to be fully
structured?
And secondly, how do we correctly
She's your mother-in-law. I mean, we know her very well. She's not worth it. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So if you pay for that,
this is a budgetary line, you get diluted, so to speak.
What happens to short-term debt. And what way does that
influence?
Oh, we were making sure, but wasn't it the other side? Shifts, or does it require some extra
stuff? There's one outside.
Response, which is not in the past. We'll see. I don't think it will, but I don't know.
Sort of Jacksonian wave, so to speak.
In a sense.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting metaphor.
The
problem is none of these metaphors work, because what was the trick?
Find out
something. How would you deal with the Jacksonian wave?
Who came up with the speakers?
Probably Elias. I don't remember. I'm sure he recommended them. Oh, maybe Elias did, but Scott, I just talked to Scott too, and I got some recommendations from Scott and from Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good mix.
I really like what it is.